listener production.
A warning. This episode contains references to child sexual abuse. If this content affects you, the number for Lifeline is 13 11 14. G'day, I'm former police officer Brent Sanders. And for the past 25 years, I've dedicated myself to sharing what I've learnt on the force to the Australian public so they can better protect themselves from falling victim to crime. So with the help of some of the most respected current and former detectives and high-ranking law enforcement agents, we're going to pull back the curtain on what life is like on the force and what they've learned about how crime and criminals really work. These are real stories from real detectives. This week, we delve into the world of child protection and understand how police investigate some of society's most heinous crimes. James Maskey joined the Queensland Police when he was just 20 and within a few years became part of the Child Protection Unit. This work demands an unwavering level of empathy, care, and attention to detail, and at times comes at a cost.
Right then and there, I experience what I now know to be as moral injury.
To start, we're going back to a case early in his career, one that would shape him for the rest of his life.
So it was the summer of 2011, 2012. It was very warm. It was about a year or so after the end of my first year. And I was working with three other police officers from Crestmead Police Station. We were four up in an undercover unmarked car, and we were undertaking a day of detecting antisocial behaviour in the unmarked police car. We received a call across police communications that there was a young boy who was lying unconscious and that he had attempted to take his own life. That's all the details that we had at that point in time. And what was racing through my mind was, you know, what are the circumstances surrounding how this came to be? And, you know, is this young boy alive? Is he no longer with us? What will I be walking into? Within about 60 seconds, lights and sirens, we were at this address. I remember jumping out of the car, running across the road, jumping over the side fence and straight into the backyard. And the first and only thing I saw, I was so focused, tunnel vision, was this young boy who was not even a teenager, let's be clear. And he was lying unconscious on the grass in his backyard. Immediately, I jumped into providing CPR. And, you know, I did that for about 5 minutes or so. Because there were so many of us in terms of the response, we were able to rotate in and out of continuing to provide that CPR support until the ambulance arrived. And for those who may have provided CPR in the past, it's quite a taxing experience physically and emotionally. And at the end of my 5 minute stint of providing compressions and resuscitation breaths, I was able to be relieved and then finally look up at the backyard and see what else I missed, what else was going on. There would have been about a dozen family members and nearby neighbours all congregating in the backyard, all wailing, all crying, all screaming, all telling police to do more and be better and save this young boy's life. And then I recall one of my partners who I was working with that day having to physically restrain the biological mother of this young boy because she was hitting her head against the brickwork of the house. She was so distraught that she started harming herself. And I had to run across and provide support and physically restrain this mother as she watched police working on the lifeless body of her young boy. And I think at such a young age, for me, that job, I was roughly, say, 22 at the time, it stayed with me for a really long time. And still to this day, I'm still unpacking why it was so impactful, because it wasn't the first suicide death. It wasn't the last suicide death, but it was the one that really stayed with me. I remember the ambulance arrived about 10 minutes after we were on scene. They took over the primary duty of providing CPR, and they loaded him up on the stretcher and continued to provide compressions, loaded him into the back of the ambulance, and then they notified us that unfortunately he had passed, he was no longer alive. And we had to share that message with the family. And that was a really impactful death message. The sheer volume of people that were there, we're now talking over a dozen people by the time this death message was delivered to the family and the friends and the neighbours. And we went to the hospital and, you know, we lodged the body with the hospital and processed all the paperwork required. Back to the station, we processed the report for the coroner, took off the gun belt, de-kitted, went home. And I remember I went to a party that night with some friends, and I was really withdrawn, very distant. I didn't want to talk about anything. And I drank so much very cheap, nasty wine. And I think for me that was a coping mechanism and a bit of a mask. If I was so inebriated, I wouldn't have to engage in conversation about how my day was. And I didn't have the words or the language to really describe what I had experienced at such a young age. And I think that experience, although it is for some police quite a routine operation they might be deployed to, for me it was a really impactful thing, and it really inspired me and drove me to want to work in the area of child protection as a police officer. I wanted to understand why and how such an incident came to be, and more importantly, what could be done, what support can be delivered to this young boy and the family and other families and other young people to ensure that they have what they require to be as well as they can and feel as connected to the community as they can. And that really drove me to want to work in the vitally important area of the Logan District Child Protection and Investigation Unit.
As a probationary constable, you're often assigned or working with somebody who's a great deal more experienced. And as you say, you know, you think you're learning the job when you're at the academy. You realise one day in, once you've left the academy, you don't really start learning until you're on the street and you're in amongst it. Mm. James, if I can take you forward to around 2012. You did a secondment on the Child Protection Investigation Unit, CPIU. Now, those who have worked in this environment would know that this is very, very impactful work. And on top of what you've been kind enough to tell us already, you must have found this very, very confronting to be working in an environment with such exposure to child exploitation and child exploitation material. Can you walk us through sort of the work that is done by officers and was done by yourself within that unit?
CPIU in Queensland holds two roles. One is juvenile justice, so serious offences committed by young people. So we're looking at, you know, recently all the high rates of youth crime in Queensland. That's certainly one aspect that CPIU deal with. The other, equally as important, if not more, is protecting young people against harm, abuse, and neglect. And that's physical harm, sexual harm, abuse, and neglect. And this is the vitally important work that the CPIU perform. And this was the focus of my 3 month secondment to CPIU initially, which ended up being a longer term full time position down the track. At that time, I was assigned to work with two detective senior constables, and one of them had just executed a search warrant and had secured a number of hard drives, laptops, and personal mobile phones. And he requested my support to go through each one of these devices because he had a suspicion that there was child exploitation material on these devices. Now, we're talking thousands of images and videos and terabytes of data, and the old clunky computer systems of the Logan District couldn't deal with that volume of data. So we had to run it up to headquarters, up to the offices of Task Force Argos, which ultimately is where I wanted to tailor my career and work long term as a detective. So we went up to Argos, we sat down, we cranked up to the computer, and I was given a number of hard drives, and I was given the duty of going through each one of them to build a brief of evidence to ascertain how many images, how many videos, but also equally as importantly, the different categories of the images and videos. So as investigators, we're tasked with child exploitation material to look at the images and videos and to categorise not only the ages of the young people depicted, but then also the acts committed against them, ranging from non-sexual fully clothed all the way through to violent in nature and also bestiality as well. So the full spectrum of categories is what we are tasked to perform in terms of looking at all the images and videos. And I can recall looking at just abhorrent images of young people as young as the ages of 4 and 5, all the way through to teenagers, videos of just violent sexual acts committed against them. And at the time, I was still roughly around 22, 23, and this wasn't my experience of the world that I held to be true. You know, I believed that young people should be nurtured and loved and cared for. And what I was seeing was directly against what I held to be true. So we ended up categorizing thousands of images and videos across a 2-week period. Every day we would drive up to headquarters in silence. We'd sit down, we'd view the images and videos. We'd drive back from headquarters in complete and utter silence. And I think for both of us, it really impacted upon our well-being. It impacted upon just our ability to be able to even hold a conversation with each other. Impactful, as you say, incidents that police are ever tasked to deal with, but also the most important. Young people are our most vulnerable victims of crime, and they are the ones that deserve the level of protection that police provide in this important CPIU unit. And still to this day, if I was to close my eyes, I could still see some of what I was asked to do as a very young, a very green investigator in this important part of the business. We ended up charging, and I was a supporting officer here, we ended up charging an offender with possessing thousands of images and videos, and he did go to prison, which is a fantastic outcome, and justice was served through the court system. So yeah, look, ultimately that secondment, once again, much like the suicide death of that young 11-year-old boy, it powered me to want to continue this vital part of policing because I saw the impact, I saw the importance, and I knew that my skill set could be applied to do it well. But at the same time, I didn't understand the toll that really took. You know, we are talking just the most violent and abhorrent acts committed against young kids recorded on video and camera.
A brief like that takes many, many months to put together. So I would imagine that for yourself, there's not even a great deal of closure around that, because if you were there for 3 months and back on uniform, I guess that would have been prior to a case like that being presented in a courtroom, or did you see it all the way through?
Yeah, and I think that's a real frustration for me, and a reoccurring theme of my policing career is the inability to see things through to fruition. And the not knowing is also a really impactful part of what I experienced. You're exactly right. I did everything that was asked of me in that 3-month period procedurally. I helped compile this really detailed brief of evidence against this offender, but ultimately the arrest and the charge and the leading through the court system was the role of the investigating officer, who ended up securing a role in Task Force Argos off the back of this really important work. So as a very junior plainclothes investigator, I wasn't in the unit full time. I pulled together statements. I helped pull together the brief and put all the charges together. But the actual job of taking it through became the job of the lead investigator through the court system.
2014, you picked up a permanent role in child protection investigation, which led to you working on a very confronting case involving a little 6-month-old. Can you walk us through that case, James, and your involvement with it?
Yes, certainly. And this came across my desk about 2 months into receiving this permanent position to the specialised unit of CPIU. It was an early morning shift. It was a weekend, and my partner and I, we were the only investigators on in the region at the time. And a call came through from police communications that was placed by Queensland Ambulance Service. They were in the process of closing up the back doors of the ambulance with a six-month-old baby on board and about to transport her up to the Brisbane Children's Hospital. And there were some very serious life-threatening injuries to this young baby. And that they're taking mum up to the hospital, but dad will remain on scene to talk with police. We kitted up, we went out the door in the car and we drove to this address, and ambulance were able to stay long enough to provide a quick handover to us. And then we spoke to the biological father of this young baby initially and conducted a search of the house to match up his version of events. Now, initially, when my partner and I spoke to the dad of this baby, he mentioned that he was up in the middle of the night, baby couldn't sleep, he had baby on the couch with him, he fell asleep watching TV, and he awoke to a thud on the floor. And when he looked down, he saw baby lying face down on the floor. Baby was unconscious but breathing. And despite all his best efforts, he walked around the house and hugged her and held her and tried to call out to her and raise some sort of consciousness. He put her in the bath, and he put her in the bath, and I quote him, I still remember these words 10 years on, to shock her into being awake. And when that didn't work, he and the mum called the ambulance. They ran out of options. So we took down all of the details of his story, recorded initially the conversation, did a search of the house to match up his version of events, and then we drove the police car up to the hospital. Went upstairs to the intensive care unit, and initially I was confronted with an image that will stay with me once again for life. This six-month-old baby breathing through a life support device hooked up to all kinds of leads and tubes. And we spoke to the medical team and we asked them to describe the extent of her injuries and could they be consistent with an injury falling off the couch, say 50 centimetres or so from the couch to the ground. Unequivocally, the response was no, not at all. And what I learned shocked me to my core and absolutely boiled my blood where I stood. And it was that baby had suffered some injuries to the extent of several fractured ribs. She had a significant bleed on the brain and her retina was detached from her eyeball. The fractured ribs, they had different heal times associated with them, indicating that they occurred maybe possibly within that 12-hour block, as Dad suggests, but also they had heal times consistent with 1 month and 3 month respectively. And they were multiple fractured ribs that occurred over a three-month period. Then I asked about the bleed on the brain and the detached retina, and is that consistent with a fall from the couch? Once again, unequivocally, no. Consistent with violent shaking was the response. So right then and there, I experienced what I now know to be as moral injury. And that is when we are confronted by something that is so heinous, that goes so far against what we hold to be true about the world and what we value, and then to learn what has happened to this young baby was just a horrendous contravening of my own morals and values and ethics. So after a period of interviewing everybody and gaining statements from everybody connected to this young baby, we then acquired the appropriate level of approvals from the court system to obtain warrants to listen into phone calls and conversations from the biological parents of this child. Once again, what I'd learned in these conversations boiled my blood. They were callous. There was no remorse. There was no aspect of feeling concern for their young one. yes, they, for all appearances, attended the hospital as often as they could and sat with the young baby. Initially, there was a breakdown in the relationship between mum and dad, and mum left dad. And then what we learned is that was more so for appearances, and that they were together the whole time. And what transpired really felt like just a horrible act by two parents who should have looked after their young kid, but completely did the opposite. Instead, they harmed her and caused life-threatening injuries across a multiple-month period. After we gathered enough evidence, we knew that we had the right level of evidential proof. And we put the charges before the court. We charged mum and dad with grievous bodily harm. And I'm proud to say that justice was delivered to this young baby. Now, out of respect for her and this young baby who now, 10 years on, would be entering into being a teenager, I don't want to necessarily share much more because I want to be respectful of her, but the incident itself is something I'll never forget.
James, I'm just wondering if I could ask you if you could sort of take us through that time, that transition from policing to leaving and pushing through. And I know that you've described it as being a very jarring process on many different levels.
So it got to a point, Brent, where I knew in my heart that I had to leave policing. And it was a culmination of a few things. I was seeing a psychologist privately outside of the service who diagnosed me with post-traumatic stress disorder. Additionally, the work that I was doing and the response that it had on me caused a relationship breakdown with my beautiful partner at the time, who's now my wife. After many years and much effort, we are back together stronger than ever, but it caused the relationship to implode. All of these things put together with the just cumulative exposure to trauma, I knew that I had to leave the police service. So in August of 2015, I filled out a report, I handed back my badge and I shook a few hands and out I left. Ultimately, I was also faced with needing to either stay in Queensland or move to Victoria. My partner, now my wife at the time, was offered a PhD placement at Melbourne University. So when we got to Victoria, got to Melbourne, we lived in Fitzroy and, I went back to uni, did some postgrad study and tried my hand at stepping back into the child protection realm, but I did it at a not-for-profit. So I walked into a leadership role at Victoria's largest not-for-profit child welfare organization. And ultimately for me, that also was quite triggering. I was working with young people on custodial orders, out of home care, who had high risk behaviors and were offending themselves. And being that close and direct to young people was triggering for me and my mental health. So I didn't really know what else to do other than in 2018. So fast forward a few years now, I saw a job advertised at Beyond Blue. It was a national engagement manager of Beyond Blue's Police and Emergency Services program. And that job was responsible for connecting the first responder sector to the work of Beyond Blue. It was a world first research study that Beyond Blue was running in terms of the mental health and well-being of police, ambulance, fire, and SES. And I thought, you know what, I'm reaching here. I'm just a former copper. What right do I have to work at anywhere else that's not a police organization? I tried, I applied, I really put myself forward and I was successful in the role. I spent 3.5 years at Beyond Blue and it's such an impactful role that I held. We drove a world first study that looked at the mental health prevalence and suicidality of police. And that was so closely aligned to my personal journey that I thought, you know what, maybe I do have transferable skills. Maybe I can do other things other than policing. Ultimately, that position was closed by the board and I met, just before I left Beyond Blue, I met two incredible humans, John Bale and Darren Lincoln from Fordham, Australia. They were just starting up a not-for-profit organisation supporting the well-being and career transition of police and other first responders. And they wanted to learn a bit more about Beyond Blue's work and what I was up to in that space. Ultimately, after I left Beyond Blue, I asked John Bale and Darren Lincoln for a job at Fordham Australia. I interviewed and here I am now as the Director of Policy at Fordham Australia, which is the nation's leading support organisation for first responders and their families. So I'm able to be of service now to this community that I still hold in such high regard, but a community that I know I can't work in anymore. I know that being a police officer is not for me anymore.
Transferable skills is something that often police are surprised that they actually have. These skills that you've picked up, that others pick up with doing the work that the police do, they often are overlooked by the person themselves, I think, aren't they, James? And that's part of that identity struggle. They think, well, I can never be anything else. These skills that I have, they can't be applied to anything other than policing. Can you just talk a bit about those skills that the police have that they may not actually be aware of, which are very much transferable into other careers?
In the role that I hold now, my job every day is to connect with politicians across the country and government departments to help them understand the value of the work of Fordham. Now, yes, I've got postgrad qualifications and all the rest, but ultimately my ability to negotiate, my ability to communicate, and my ability to share value, that actually harks back to policing. That tactical communication, the laser focus on a target and an end goal, and the ability to do the work and have the ethic behind myself to really do those things. This is what we as police bring to the table. And if you are considering about leaving the service, it doesn't have to be done in a way that is jarring. It doesn't have to be done in a way that is unsupported. We at Fordham, we have a program, but I know there's many other organizations out there as well. And these programs are free. They're evidence-based and they're accessible to all first responders who are transitioning. And this is really, really important. It doesn't have to be done alone anymore.
Thank you, James, for your service to the good people of Logan in those very, very tough environments. But thank you also for the work that you now do and that you continue to do. And it's just interesting, isn't it, James, how where life takes us. It's just interesting that these sliding door moments that we have in our lives and in some way, all those experiences that you had in the police and the skin that you lost along the way has set you up for this career that you're in now and the work that you're doing, which goes out to assist both serving frontline workers and also those going through that transitional period. So, James, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you for sharing some time here with us. And I just want to wish you all the very best. Thank you.
Brent, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure and thank you for all that you do.
Crime Insiders Detectives is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Brent Sanders, produced by Ed Gooden, and sound designed and imaged by Link Kelly.